Okay, let's get going.
I bet you everybody knows what the first slide is going to be. Any thoughts on brainstorming? Any questions that you might have? Anything at all? I know you guys have been thinking hard about what's been presented to you. Is it all sinking in and making sense? It must be. I can't believe that the speakers have such clarity. Yeah. Anyway, I'm always interested to hear what you guys are thinking. So if you please email me with your thoughts at any time, I'm happy to receive those and happy to have a discussion with you on some of the stuff that's been presented. So just a few items. There's been a few handouts. If you haven't picked up handouts from previous lectures, I have a pile of them here for you to take. Nothing new today, so. And these handouts are all online as well. If I sent you an email about you missing a required lecture, as I mentioned last time, the lecture audio is uploaded to the website. The slides are up there, as well as any handout material and any videos as well. So if you need to make up a lecture, please review all that material and send me a 1 to 2 page summary of your lecture, including your thoughts. And, you know, basically what I like to see is that you've, you know, listened to the whole lecture and that you're thinking about it and you can, you know, tell me what you feel about it. So that's what I'm looking for. Just a few items to start out. How many people have gone to the course website so far? Great. Yeah, I put a lot of time and effort into that to make it all up there. So, I put links up there as well. So please use that as a resource. As far as teams, I received some emails about teams and, you know, they're in the process of forming and preferences and stuff like that. It would be good if you could, you know, finalize, you know, your teams and your project and select the project and let me know as soon as you can, because the quicker you do that, the quicker you can start on your project. And again, if you have any problems or issues, or if there's not enough people to make a team of three, then you can have a team of two. I don't want to have teams of one, so if there's like four people left over, they should be on two teams of two. If you want, I can facilitate that process, but I'd rather have you guys, you know, do your own selection. And if you have any questions beyond what you heard and what you've seen about the projects, you know, please talk to me. I might be able to give you some more information that would be helpful for you making a decision on what project you might pursue. Okay. Professor Nelson asked me to ask you guys how many people are going to be taking ME 113 next quarter who are working on team projects. Okay, I know about you guys already. Okay. You know, like I said, that's an excellent opportunity for people going into 113, if they have the project of a specific that's big enough, you know, that's what make a good ME 113 project, and so maybe that will happen this year. Okay, so let me close the door. So today I'm going to have a little, I decided since we had the brainstorming session on Tuesday that we'd have a little discussion on failure. What a weird topic to have, you know. It has a lot of negative connotations, but is failure really a negative thing? Is it really the opposite of success? Is it something to avoid at all costs? Are some kinds of failures better than others? So these are the things I'm going to talk about. So, you know, with failure, the opposite of failure sometimes is success, and we've all heard of this. If at first you don't succeed, try again. But there's times when maybe If at first you don't succeed, don't take up skydiving. Because you only have one chance there. With everything else that you do, you know, hopefully you have several chances. And we all heard of the Apollo 13 slogan, failure is not an option. Who knows why failure was not an option? There's three reasons. Cost? Wasn't on my top three. Yeah, there is people involved. Yeah, that's number one. Two more things. Oh, Nicole?
Publicity,
well, yeah, that's sort of part of it. But a little bit more specific or different. Well, wasn't the U.S. prestige at stake? And engineering, you know how good. If people died, you know, that would be a black mark on not only the U.S. but as you know the U.S. Scientific effort as well. So that's why failure was not an option there. But in reality, failure is always an option because you know if you don't succeed. It's considered a failure, and you can buy a T-shirt that says that on it. And Adam Savage from the MythBusters says that a lot. But you know, there's been a lot said about failure by lots of different people, and I'm going to explore that a little bit. Mary Pickford was an actress in the silent movie days, and she said failure is not falling down; it's not getting up again. So that's sort of like, you know, if you fall off a horse, you should get back on it again. So that means, you know, you gotta try again. You know, it's not the end of your effort. You know, one failure is not the end of your effort. You know, you have a chance to try again. And Thomas Edison said, "I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways that won't work." So he failed to succeed in 10,000 times. So he was probably an expert in failure, according to that. So what was he trying to do to succeed? What was he in search of specifically? Excuse me? Yes, that wouldn't burn up. So he tried lots of things, and a lot of them burnt up. When he finally found the right material, there was a light that went off above his head. But, you know, in thinking about this, you know, if you fail so many times, you know, you must not understand the problem well enough. So if you fail 10,000 times, you probably need to know more about the science of what's going on. So that was my sort of take on this. And other folks have said, if you want to increase your success rate, then double your failure rate. Oh, what a interesting idea that failure is key to your success. So Thomas Watson said, you can be discouraged by failure or you can learn from it. So go ahead and make mistakes. Make all you can because remember, that's where you'll find success at the far side of failure. So who knows who Thomas Watson was? Not some of the old folks, the students. I want you to think about it. Who knows? Do you know which company had the model think? Three letters.
IBM.
IBM, right. So he was the president of IBM. So that's sort of interesting. And other people have said things. It says, not many people are willing to give failure a second opportunity. They fail once and it's all over. If you're willing to accept failure and learn from it, if you're willing to consider failure as a blessing in disguise and bounce back, you've got the potential of harnessing one of the most powerful success forces. So failure is a success force, which is interesting. Yes? Well, that's certainly an option for you to consider that what you're trying to do might be impossible. Right. You know, for example, if you try a particular method of getting something done and it doesn't work and you're pushing your head, beating your head against the wall, you know, maybe there's something else. Maybe you need to back up a little bit and try something else. So that's right. Failure should be our teacher, not our undertaker. Failure is delay, not defeat. It is a temporary detour, not a dead end. And from honest failure can come valuable experience. So these are all sort of casting failure in a positive sense, that you get past the failure and there's success. And that's sort of important to know. And one of our founding fathers, Benjamin Franklin, said, failure to prepare is preparing to fail. So you need to plan. You need to prepare. You need to do your homework and understand, you know, what's going on. So from our founding father, Ben Franklin, we go to our cartoon father, Homer Simpson, who says, trying is the first step towards failure. Well, if you don't try at all, you know, you're never gonna fail, but you're never gonna succeed. So you need to try if you want to succeed. But if you abhor failure, maybe you shouldn't even attempt anything. And Professor Dave Beach says to his students, embrace failure just for these reasons. He has the whole class get up and scream that. So, and I saw this ad in a journal recently. So, fail faster, succeed sooner. So, what that means is you got to try things a lot. And the faster you go through your failures, the sooner you get to success. And I like this one the best. John Keats, the poet, said, failure is the highway to success. That's a very succinct statement. So you're going down this highway, and all you're doing is failing, but you know as long as you keep on going, there's going to be success at the end. So how does this fit into, you know, what you do as teams and what you do on projects? So here are the messages, I think, that comes out of this. You need to prototype early and often. Use it, you know, as much ways as you can to generate ideas and explore different concepts, and use CAD, cardboard-aided design, or foam core, or whatever materials you have. So that's important. It's good to employ all your knowledge, skills, senses, and engineering intuition. Well, as students, you may not have a whole lot of that, but this is how you build, you know, intuition, by doing stuff. And, of course, you want to make good use of the expertise of your team members, your coaches, and any resources and resource people that you have given to you. In regard to time, you need to balance your planning and fabrication tasks. I was relating a story about a student I work with who she loved to brainstorm. And she loved to brainstorm so much she couldn't get past it. Everything she did, Every person she met said, let's brainstorm. And she basically never got through the brainstorming phase. So you have to plan and manage your time, know how long it's going to take, you know, to do a brainstorming. Then, you know, someplace you got to move on. So it's important to know that. And in working with a lot of students, you know, it seems to me that they have an idea that they have a task to do, and it's over there, and, you know, move step by step, you know, toward that, and as long as they keep on working and going in a linear fashion, they're going to reach their goal. Well, you know, if you have failures, if things are unexpected, then that path may not be linear. So you might have to take some detours. And you have to prepare for those detours, prepare for your mistakes, and prepare to experience failures. That should be part of your process. You need to plan for them, understand them, and learn from them. And most of all, don't give up. You might get discouraged, but you got to keep on going. Okay. I hope that helps. So just a little bit of a discussion. We talked about Apollo 13. Do you think it was a success or a failure? You remember it was supposed to, you know, go to the moon and land on the moon and stuff, but didn't achieve that goal. What do you think? Oh, Nicole, did you?
It was a successful failure.
Okay, that's a good one.
That's what they called it in the movie anyways.
Okay, well, we all believe what they say in the movies. Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Yes. Right. Okay. Well, it sort of brings up, you know, another thing. You know, last year we had that plane landing in the Hudson River. You know, that's when you take a look at the flight itself. You know, it didn't go where it was supposed to go, but everybody survived. So, again, it's sort of the same issue. This, so, you know, when it comes down to it, maybe, you know, the fact that no human life was lost is more important than the goal of the project. Okay. I'm not saying that should be your goal. Yeah, we had a successful project. Nobody died. Oh, God. How about the Concorde? You know, that was that airplane, and here's its final takeoff where it's in flames. And, you know, I should, if you remember, the plane was perfectly fine, and it just sucked up something into the engines, and that caused the engines to catch fire. But after that, they had no more flights. All the planes were grounded, taken out of service. So, I mean, should you test an airplane, you know, for sucking up, you know, a piece of metal in the engine? Shall we test planes to fly into flocks of birds, see if they if the plane fails? Maybe not. Yeah, but that's, yeah, they flew a long time. It wasn't very cost effective. It was sort of a luxury type thing, but I don't think the age of the plane had anything to do with this failure. Excuse me? Right, yeah, but it wasn't the fault of that airplane or the design of that airplane. I don't think any airplane could survive a big hunk of metal in the engine. Okay. They have somebody walk the runway between every flight?
Not everybody. I mean, like, if you're on, like, a carrier,
yeah,
you walk that deck.
Yeah.
It's
right.
So I'm trying to stand here, but I guess I'm defending the plane more than
yeah. Well, I'm not accusing the plane of anything. I'm just bringing up the situation. So what ultimately determines success or failure is, it, you know, that the planes continue to fly, or, I mean, in this case, you know, with this plane, you know, people died. So, and can something be a partial success or failure? Anybody? You know, well, maybe. I mean, it's all definition. You know, I mean, you know, if your job depends on success, you might say. You might say in the positive terms, well, we achieved this and this and this and failed to achieve that and that, you know, to boost yourself up. But no, if the other things are more important, then maybe you didn't fully succeed. So that's that. Okay. So next Tuesday, we're going to have a doubleheader. The first half hour will be Doug Schwant, and he's going to talk about, he's a mechanical engineer that used to work with me at the VA. And he's a consultant now, and he's worked on assistive technology. So he's like the prototypical success story for a mechanical engineer working on assistive technology devices. And he'll tell you some of the projects that he's worked on and some of the strategies that he's used to be successful. So it's always very interesting, and that's why I have him back every year. Then my colleague Maurice LeBlanc will tell us about a venture that he's working with. This prosthetic hand, which is a hand for kids who have lost their hands in Africa. So he's going to talk about his involvement in the design of the hand and stuff. So that ought to be really interesting. But today we have Debbie Kenny. How long ago did we take that picture?
I was trying to remember if I was pregnant with Thomas, who's now almost 17 years old.
Okay, it's an old picture.
Old picture.
So Debbie has been an occupational therapist for the last 17 years, splitting her time between Stanford and the VA healthcare system, and she worked with me at the Rehab R&D Center there, where she collaborated on numerous design development research projects with both engineers and grad students. Her work has included testing and integrating technology into the rehab setting with individuals with Parkinson's disease, stroke, spinal cord injury, hand therapy, and balance problems related to aging. She currently works with post-stroke survivors and coordinates a research project at the Stanford Medical Center, and is also a frequent guest lecturer at the Multiple Sclerosis Society of Santa Clara. So I'll turn the laser pointer and the microphone over to her, and I'll change the slides.
We need to clear this.
Okay.
Just take a second.
Here, put this on.
If you need to, go ahead and stand up and stretch. This would be a good time. If you have trouble seeing small things up front, come up a little bit closer, and I do expect that this will be an interactive session, that you won't just be sitting there and looking at the slides. I brought a lot of tools of my profession, some very basic ones, and some a little less basic. Thanks. We probably won't have time to go through all the stuff that I brought, and we'll leave room at the end of the lecture for you guys to explore what's in the suitcase here. I also brought two of my students, and I was hoping more, but I got a couple calls that people weren't coming in because of sickness and weather from the REACH program. That's the post-stroke program that I work with. And And those students are here to answer questions that you might have about end users and end users' views about different adaptive equipment that they've been issued, different adaptive equipment they wish they had been issued, things that they maybe want but can't get. So lots of different areas. One second. Guys. Right, that's where we're at. So before we start really talking about the entire rehabilitation team and what we do and how we use adaptive technology, let's be all clear about what we're talking about when we talk about adaptive technology in the rehab setting. So here we have it as an object or a tool that maximizes a person's independent of activities of daily living. So what does ADLs mean? I've used this term before when I was here last week, and we want to talk about ADLs, activities of daily living. So that's everything you need from the time you get up till the time you go to sleep and in between. So self-care, can you get yourself into bed? Can you feed yourself? Can you prepare your own food? Can you do your dressing? Can you do your toileting? And the list could go on, right? And then, but it's not just about self-care, of course, in your daily life. We need balance always in our daily life. Hopefully all of you have some balance, even though you're students. But there is some balance in work, play, and self-care. So we have our leisure, hobbies, our sports, our travel, and of course work. And for you, work is being what? A student. Yeah. So when we give a piece of adaptive equipment to somebody, a patient that comes through either outpatient or inpatient rehab, why do we do this? Let's talk about this first. So our main goal in an inpatient setting is that a person will be able to discharge to home, that they will be independent enough to prevent any further decline in any of the skills that they need, that they can basically take care of themselves. We don't want them to go to a skilled nursing facility or anything else like that. Okay. So, but we talk about there's a lot of different areas. So the team is not just an OT. A team will go over a whole list, deals with things like mobility, again, self-care, communication, and again, leisure. Anybody know what this is? Anybody want to take a guess at what this is? Huh? A mobile beach chair. That is what it is. It's a mobile beach chair. And I know Santa Cruz, one of the beaches in Santa Cruz has a mobile beach chair. So if you were in a regular wheelchair and you try to use your regular wheelchair out there on the sand, what do you think would happen to the wheels? They'd sink right in. But here you have a mobile wheelchair, and I had a friend who was quadriplegic but was also a scuba diver. So would use a device like this in order to get into the water. Okay. And we talk about vocation. I don't know if you can see this really well in this picture. Is this a laser pointer too, Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you see this? This is an electric wheelchair. And it goes in from a seated position to a standing position. The guy's actually welding. And he wouldn't be able to do that unless the chair helped him to stand. Yeah, it has really, really big wheels on it that are like dune buggy wheels. Okay, instead of the really thin wheels that most wheelchairs have. So there's different levels of assistive technology that we deal with in a rehabilitation setting. I love this cartoon, and it shows a guy reaching an apple on a tree, and then it shows this thing that's ratcheting down, and it shows him going back in the wheelchair. It says, why make it simple when you can make it difficult? So you have to be careful in a rehab setting about making things too difficult. And we'll explain why in a minute. So the first thing that we look at when we're looking at assistive technology or adaptive technology is we're looking at low-tech tools. So when we talk about low-tech tools, we're talking about things like finger spelling, being able to scoot up and down the stairs, my favorite, of course, Velcro. What will we do without Velcro? I mean, and elastic waistbands, that's another really great one. Here's some other examples of low-tech adaptive equipment. Here we have a thing that looks like a springy corkscrew. Anybody? Shoelace. And instead of tying the shoelace, all you have to do is take the ends and what? Twist. Now you've got it secured. Okay, real low tech, real low tech. Could we develop a machine that would actually tie your shoe for you? Sure. Does that make any sense? Of course not. Okay. So again, it doesn't require electrical power. May require some short training period. I just trained you in how to use the shoelace. How long did that take? Not very long. Okay. Sometimes low-tech tools have become a regular part of our everyday society. Here's a belt-up pen grip that's part of a pen that's actually somebody gave out at some, you know, conference or whatever. But we use belt-up pen grips all the time in rehabilitation if you've got somebody who has arthritis or some other problem with their grip and they can't grip strong. Yep, there you go. You got the gel grips on that pen. It's become a natural part of what we do, and we don't even think twice about it. Here's another example of low-tech adaptive technology that has become a part of kind of everyday culture, and this is the Reach flosser. And instead of having to hold the floss, of course, between two fingers, it's already held for you, okay? Now we move up to kind of elementary technology devices, something that includes battery-operated devices. May require a moderate amount of training, and this is really important. It's about the training aspect of it. You don't just give a walker, you don't just give a wheelchair without providing some training. I know some people who've done that, and it's a bad, bad thing. What ends up happening is people don't know how to use it, they don't know it's normal, they end up not using it. Okay. And we have all kinds of modified eating utensils. I have here a simple piece of foam that can be added to an eating utensil, but there's all kinds of different eating utensils that you can modify. Again, you have to... do you want me to pass around? It seems like the class is really big this time, Dave. What do you think? Okay. We can pass these things around. I'm happy to pass them around. All right. And then we have higher technology devices, which usually require an extensive amount of training. They tend to be very expensive. The examples I give here are a voice-operated environmental control unit, so something that you can say, answer the phone for me, or turn on the light, or that kind of stuff. You see the box here, and this is a communication device, an electronic communication device, or we have doorbells that can be fitted, modified cars and vans, motorized wheelchairs. Requires a special amount of training that's probably double or more than giving somebody a regular wheelchair. When you're giving somebody even a regular wheelchair, you have to teach them how to get in and out of it. How do you get over a doorway? If you've got a lip on the doorway, what do you do? As I said, you can't just give them the device. So we have really this continuum from very low tech to much higher tech. And here I use the example of the mechanics of writing. And we start off with a regular pen or pencil. And then we get a pen or pencil that has an adaptive grip. And then maybe we have adaptive paper that has ridges on it, or you have a stylus to create the letters. And I don't know, do you use a stylus on regular paper when you write? No? Okay. And slant boards help with what we call proprioception, knowing where your body is in space. Some kids press too hard on their pen or pencil. We need to teach them how to not do that. I still have typewriter in here. That's nobody uses typewriter anymore, but back in the days. Of course, computers, portable note-taking devices. There's all kinds of stuff coming out now. And, of course, what's really cool now is the voice recognition software like Dragon Dictate or Dragon Naturally Speaking. It's about a $200 software system. You can use it in your computer. Yeah, talk into your computer, and it types out. Now, you have to train it. It's not automatic. You can't just go and sit and plug that software in and just expect it to behave and not type funny things. My kid, who has a learning problem, uses that sometimes to help with his writing, and we get some funny words, and we get a good laugh out of it. Okay. And this guy here is actually typing with his what in this picture? He's typing with his feet. You don't have to type with your fingers. Okay, so let's go and talk about this team, this rehab team, this transdisciplinary team. So you have a word here that most of you probably have never seen before. Physiatrist is how it's pronounced. Have you? There's this guy who plays guitar down in San Diego with his feet. And you can do all kinds of amazing things with your feet. And I've seen people eat with their feet. And there's some really cool stuff. Check out YouTube.
Yeah, but can you actually, you can grab things.
Oh, yeah. No, these guys, that's how he plays the guitar. He can actually independently move each of his toes to do things. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you train yourself. You train yourself early, you can do those kinds of things. It's the same kind of thing like some of us have problems separating out our little finger from a ring finger, but you look at a pianist and they're really able to do that. And that's how you have to train yourself to be able to do that. It's not necessarily an innate task that you can do, but you can train yourself to do that. It's all where there's a motivation and where there's a will. And I should point out, too, that what's really important here with the transdisciplinary team is that we're not treating somebody with a disability. We're not treating a disability. We're treating a person. And that person is the person that the transdisciplinary team is treating, not the disease, okay? So that's a really important concept. We're not treating the disease, we're treating the person. Okay. Physiatrist. Anybody heard that term before? Ooh, somebody's heard that term before. And what does that term mean? Yeah, rehabilitation medicine doctor. Yeah, very good. That's surprising. Okay, great. But along with that physiatrist, we have this whole huge team of people that are working. We got social workers. We have the OTs. We have the speech and language pathologist, who you heard from the other week. We have the prosthetist, like Maury LeBlanc. We have adaptive technology equipment vendors and consultants. We have hearing and sight specialists. We have physical therapists, the audiologists, nurse practitioners, the people who make splints and other adaptive devices, lots of different people. And, of course, we got the family that's involved. That's also part of the team. Okay. So it's a continuum, and everybody needs to work together for the best interest of the individual. Okay. And, again, let me just briefly mention about OT. So we're here to assist people to be as independent as possible and to have balance in their life and work, play, and self-care. A little bit different between PT and OT is that we use functional activities as a way of promoting wellness or a way of, let's say a problem would be a problem with strength. I could sit there and have you take a piece of TheraBand and stretch that TheraBand and sit there and stretch that TheraBand, and I can have you stretch it 10 times a day for 20 reps, and how bored are you going to be and how well are you going to actually follow through with the treatment plan? Well, OTs take a little different perspective. We would say, okay, well, let's see. Oh, you've got a niece or a nephew, and that niece or nephew is young, and they like to go to the playground. And I can have you go to the playground, and I can have you push them on the swing. That's a functional way of doing the exact same task. Which will motivate you more? Something that motivates you from within. Again, we're treating the individual. We're not treating the disability. You have an individual who has deficits, not a disability. So we treat the whole person. So how do we get this equipment from the vendors, from whomever, to the end user? Well, first, we have to have a prescription, typically, from the MD. There's certain pieces of equipment you can go out there now. You can go to Rite Aid. You can buy things like a socket, you know, socks, special socks. This is a washing mitt. So if you didn't have grip and you needed to wash, but you had shoulder movement and you had elbow movement, you could use this little mitt and you could sit there and you could wash with this little mitt. You can get that at the store, you know. And a lot of the low-tech gear are now available. They didn't used to be. 10 years ago, things were different. But now that's changed somewhat. But our primary goal when we give a piece of equipment is that the equipment gets used properly and that the person feels that the equipment is important to them, to help them, that they continue to be able to use that device, that they do not discontinue that device. And I have here of kind of a chart, and you can see there's a lot of different factors. There's the device characteristics, how the service is provided, and then there's a lot of personal factors, the social aspect, the personal factors, the health status, the economic factors, the physical environment, the demographics, the equipment, counter effects, are the alternative solutions, and is the device lost? If we look at just these things, like the social aspects, when I'm talking about social aspects, I'm talking about things like culture. For instance, if I come in and I'm working with an older Filipino family member, and they know that the family is expected to take care of them, and I insist on giving them every single piece of adaptive equipment to help them to get dressed, do you think they're going to use it? The answer is probably not. right? And because it's part of the culture, right? You take care of your elders. Yeah, and if I'm imposing my own values and my own strictures on that, I'm not really working with the person as an individual. So I have to be really respectful of people's culture, okay? And what kind of support do they have? And you'll see why support is important. I'll show you, you know, do you have somebody at home to help that person with that piece of adaptive equipment if they need it? Are the people motivated to use that piece of adaptive equipment? Again, am I imposing my own ideas on that person? And what's the perception of self? And when we talk about the perception of self, what we're talking about is, does the person see themselves as just another person with limitations, or do you see themselves as disabled? People's view of themselves and how they view themselves and how you view them will affect the ability to accept a piece of equipment. If they see that a piece of equipment is making them look more disabled, they're not going to accept it well. It's interesting. Funny thing is, guys, women are more accepting of that kind of pieces of equipment than men are. It's just a fact. So again, we talk about gender here as an important aspect and personal factors, the age of a person. Older people may not be willing to accept a piece of equipment that's got a lot of computer gizmos and something that they don't know about and that they don't feel comfortable with, right? Okay. What's their level of education? Again, a little bit about their diagnosis. Do they have changing health factors that might change the need for that equipment? And believe it or not, where you live, if you live out in the boonies versus living in the city, can affect how people accept equipment. Do they rent it? Do they own it? Medicare, Medi-Cal? Is there stairs in the house? What's going on in the house? What's going on in the physical environment that might preclude somebody from using that piece of equipment you want to give them that you think is going to make them independent soon? So it's not just a simple thing saying, oh, Mr. X, you've got this disease. I'm going to give you this piece of equipment. It's just not that simple. So here's an example from an article about a long-handled sponge. This is a long-handled sponge. It's got a long handle. It's got a big round sponge on the end. And it's for use for reaching parts that you can't reach because maybe you can't bend or you can't move your arm as much, whatever reason, long-handled sponge. Given to a lot of patients who've had things like hip replacement surgery. So you can be able to wash your feet. You're not allowed to bend. Well, we don't want you bending beyond 90 degrees after hip surgery because you can pop out your prosthesis, okay? So we say, don't do this. So here we give you this piece of equipment. Here we give you the sock aid. Here we give you the shoe thing. So we're looking at a two-month follow-up after hospital stay. And out of 100 people who the device was given to and prescribed to at follow-up, how many people were still using the device? So about 70% of the people were using the device and 30% of the people were not using the device anymore. And if we look at the reasons why people weren't using the device, they might have used it at some point. About half have used it at some point, half never used it. So you have to say, why didn't they use it? Well, something, they didn't need it. Some people, again, like we talked about with cultural stuff or support at home, had other help. Sometimes people think it didn't work. If it didn't work, whose fault is that? It's the therapist's fault because we didn't train the person properly in how to use that piece of equipment. And then there's other reasons. And at 12-month follow-up, you look and that there's a few people still using the device at a 12-month follow-up. But overall, not. You have to be careful about giving people too many pieces of equipment. Because you just end up cluttering their house. And it's really overwhelming going from a hospital setting back to a home setting. It's difficult. And the training is done in the hospital. Now, let's look at something that's a little bit more high-tech. This is the Sabo Flex, and we actually brought a Sabo Flex here for you today to look at after at the end of the lecture. Sabo Flex is used primarily for people who've had a stroke who can't open their hand up. It's a series of springs that opens the fingers up, and you see this fingertip. You have to be able to get your fingers in the fingertip, and then it helps to open. So a lot of people who've had a stroke are able to form a nice grasp, but not open their hand because of spasticity. Their muscles on their flexor side, their flexors, making the fist, are tighter than their extensors. Their extensors are weak. The things that open the hand are weak. So what do we notice here? First thing, we got a big price tag on this baby. It's $1,690. Sometimes your insurance might pay for part of it. If you're a retired person, do you think you got that kind of money laying around to do that? Well, maybe not. Now, the biggest other problem about this is that it's really almost impossible to put on by yourself. It kind of works neat. It's really effective in getting people's shoulder and elbow moving. Funny thing is that you look at the research on it, too, and the research on it doesn't show that, except in a very few cases, that it actually improves hand opening when you're not using the device after a training period. So here's an example of a piece of equipment you'd have to be very, very careful how and who you gave this to. You would have to give this to the right person, somebody who could afford it, somebody who could don and doff it independently.
And even if it doesn't necessarily solve the problem, it does make it easier.
Yeah, except that in this particular design, what you don't see here, and you'll see when you actually see the device, is that the fingertips are totally encased in this device. So you have no sensation here with your fingertips other than pressure on an object. And so it's kind of for a gross grasp, gross opening, but again, you don't have that kind of tactile feedback that would be a better way of doing that particular device. Could you design something? It's been working on it.
Why doesn't it work?
Because the way you introduced it, you said that it actually does support the muscle, and it actually helps the muscle. Yeah. Because part of the problem is that with people who've had a stroke, that they have a lot of muscle weakness. Here we're aiding it. We're aiding the weak muscle, but we're not necessarily strengthening the weak muscle. Okay, so we haven't really overcome the problem. It's neat because you're moving the shoulder and you're moving the elbow more, which are easier things to move in somebody who's had a stroke, but not necessarily the hand and the finger and the wrist, where if you've got it stuck like this and we can show you. You can see some tone stuff with the students. So there's a lot of steps that we need to look at when we issue an assistive device. We want to look at this, what activity we're using it for. What are our methods of instructions? Are we only instructing again in the hospital? Are people going to forget when they go home? Okay. How much time have we had to introduce device? How long do you think people stay in the hospital for these days after a stroke? No, a little bit longer than 2 days. A little bit longer than 2 days. Anybody want to guess? Yeah, a couple weeks. That's it. And this is from a newly diagnosed stroke. You basically have a couple weeks to get somebody who may be not moving half of their body and is having to come to terms now with the fact that their body and their life has changed remarkably, and that's not a long time. Okay. How do we reinforce its use? And can we give written justifications to the insurance company, which is important for, of course, for being able to get somebody to be able to afford a device. Repetition is key. How do you demonstrate it? Do you do it written? Do you do a video? Do you do in-home training? Do you practice the actual skills in the hospital? At VA hospital, for instance, we actually have a unit where you can stay in this apartment prior to going home, and you can try out some of these things. Nursing staff's there if you need them, but they pretty much leave you alone in the apartment if you don't ring for them. So it gives you kind of a taste. Most people don't get that. That's unusual. VA is a really great place to have rehab. Again, transition, follow-up, support groups, refresher training may be necessary in the device. And who pays? Who pays for that SaboFlex? Well, if you're young enough, maybe you can get half of it paid for by your medical insurance. But if you're on Medicare, They're not going to pay for it. If you're on Medicaid, they certainly won't pay for it. VA's been really generous with their equipment. I'm really, you know, when we work with people, we're really lucky that we can order them the equipment we need. Medicare says things like this. You can have a transfer bench to the bathtub, something you sit down in the bathtub or the shower, but you can't have a commode chair and a transfer bench. You can't have a little toilet next to your bed to keep you from having to go all the way down the hall to your bathroom in the middle of the night. You can have one or the other, but you can't have both. Does it make sense? No, but that's the rules. So a lot of times that adaptive technology that is more complex isn't going to need to be paid for by the individual. So we look again at rehabilitation services, and we look and see maybe only 50% of the people are getting the equipment that they need for a disability, and 40% are only getting the rehab that they need. Okay, what does this mean to you? Anybody? It means to you, you better involve all of your stakeholders when you're doing your design process. Okay. End users, definitely. Therapists who might be doing the training, you bet. Okay. Family members who might have to help to reinforce that training, that would be good. See what people think of this, you know, whatever you're coming up with. And look and see what already exists. It's interesting how many students that I've worked with from this course, and it's like they'll come, you know, say, blah, 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 and I'll go, oh, yeah, that exists. And there's a lot of adaptive equipment that's out there. As I said, it's not necessarily getting into everybody's hands. It's not necessarily known. So you have to take a look at, do you want to modify the design or do you want to design something from the ground up?
So this might be a nonsensical statistic, but do you know how many people with disabilities, many physical disabilities, live with family members? Because, for example, I have a grandmother who's in a wheelchair, but she doesn't live with my family, immediate family.
It depends on different countries. There's different statistics. You know, it's, again, it's a cultural thing. There's now, luckily, because of the fact that, you know, if you look 20 years ago, it was a lot different, that the families were a lot more extended. Now you're seeing a lot more people in assistive living situations. But we're trying to keep people as independent as possible, even within those constraints, even if they can't live with their family. But assistive living has its severe limitations at what they can do. For instance, I have a guy who has urinary incontinence problems at night and really doesn't want to be in a diaper. And you can understand that, okay? And so we found that he could use a condom cath. Well, the assistive living facility will not allow anybody, his wife or anybody else, to put on that condom catheter because they're not trained nurses. Price, 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 price. Watch out with the price. I designed a little thing for actually helping to do toilet hygiene. Really simple. A stick with a little pivoting end that would hold the toilet paper. Couldn't manufacture it. They thought it was really great. Couldn't manufacture it because it cost too much to manufacture. It's an interesting problem that we have in the rehab area. Cost is critical, again, because of the big markup on things. Here's some resources. These slides will all be online. They're online, so you can look at these. These are some really great articles if you're just interested in adaptive equipment and factors affecting older adults and principles and practices of assistive technology. This is one of my favorite. You know, it has things that are made, things that were previously made. Able Data, www.abledata.com. Great. Here's two companies. There's many more that do assistive adaptive equipment. North Coast Medical is one. Smith Nephew, it used to be Smith Nephew and Rolian. They've separated out now. Is another company that you can contact and look on their website to see if, again, as I said, when you go into the design process, you should see what's done in the area already and kind of build from there. Don't try to, as I said, recreate the wheel when you don't need to. Okay. And as I said, I brought a lot of other pieces of adapt equipment. What's our time looking like? Okay, let me take a few more minutes to introduce you to a few other pieces of adaptive equipment that I love. And this one that looks like Alibaba and the 40 Thieves giant scimitar is... Anybody? Has to do with people who only have use of one arm, one hand. My students know what this is. This is a rocker knife. Thanks. Yeah. So she's armed and dangerous. This is a rocker knife. So if you were to cut food, what do you normally do to cut food? You usually stabilize it with a fork and then you saw. If you try to just saw your food, what's going to happen? Your food's going to move all over the place. So instead of using a sawing motion, you rock the knife, and it stabilizes the food. Very simple, very simple. Okay. I don't know if you want me to pass that one around. I'll leave some of these up here. Another thing, we talked about hand opening being a problem for both sometimes younger people with cerebral palsy or other medical conditions, or people with arthritis, and especially women develop arthritis here in this joint at the base of the thumb a lot. This is great. All we have is a little kind of a spring on the end of our scissors, and now we have scissors that open automatically for you, okay? So very easy, little, simple devices. Let's see. Okay. This is, again, another device for somebody who has use of one hand. Again, if you were to... try to chase your peas around the plate with one hand and a spoon. It might be a little difficult, but if you have a built-up edge, some people have these little things that they even bring with them to restaurants and build up the edges on them. This is a fancy one. Again, it has a non-slip bottom on it, so you can push your peas or whatever up against there. Okay. Do you know what people do usually when they go to restaurants and they have that problem where they have one hand and they need to cut up food? Yeah. Huh? Smush the peas? Well, smush the peas. But what if you had the steak? I've gone for the prime rib. What am I going to do? I guess I could bring my scary knife with me, but what other thing could I do? Uh-huh, in the kitchen. Definitely. So there's a lot of ways of kind of going around and doing things. And I had showed you the sock aid the other day. Here's another sock aid. Again, just a little trough that your sock fits over, and you would take your foot, put it in there, and pull on the sock. Okay? I'm not going to do that all the way. This is actually a TED hose that's on there. But my favorite piece of equipment is, I'm getting, this is my last one, I promise, is Dysom. And I believe every engineering project should have a piece of Dysom. Dysom is this wonderful, wonderful rubber-based material with a high friction coefficient, and it's great. So, like, if you have to scoop ice cream one-handed, your ice cream's going to move again all over the place. But if you got something like Dysom, I'm leaning up against this, and I'm not moving anywhere, okay? I'm not going anywhere. So Dysom's my favorite stuff. So if you have to have something that really needs to have, you know, sticky, you need to have somebody's hand stick to it and not slip off of it, Dysom's great stuff. This is a little bit dusty, this little piece, but we'll pass it around. Now, I want to bring up my students. So you guys need to come up so you can face the rest of the class. You want me to take that? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my students brought with them a couple pieces of equipment. And it's interesting, they come from...
I need some more of a leash here.
You want to introduce yourself?
Hi. I'm Michael, and I had my stroke about 4.5 years ago.
And what's your background in?
When I had my stroke, I was a VP of sales and marketing in my own company. And I was in Japan, and stroke hit me. And things changed overnight.
Right.
So that's going to be a surprise.
Yeah, I should say.
To say a little bit.
Okay, and Jackie, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Jackie Huen. I got a stroke 20 months ago. I'm still recovering from my stroke. My background, I run an engineering consulting company. Well, you all guys want to do that later on in life. Balance your life. That'd be the lesson. So I got a stroke in May 09 after finishing the invoice to my client. So as a stroke survivor and an engineer consultant in communication, so I got a lot of insight on the products. So later on we can share what my thinking. Yeah.
So these guys are both really good in being able to talk about their experience, and they're here to answer questions that you guys have about, again, about adaptive equipment that may have been given, may not have been given. Like, what did you leave the hospital with, Jackie?
I leave the hospital only in a wheelchair and a brace.
Yeah. Both of you guys wear what we call AFOs. We were talking about this, about these are both very low-level AFOs. That means that these people actually have a fair amount of balance and movement.
But the reason my AFO goes up
all the way up. Yeah.
And that was so uncomfortable, even though I didn't have the sensation.
Right.
But it was a good motivating factor for me to get out of it.
So, you went with what kind of equipment?
Pretty much the same. I had a wheelchair and my AFO. That's it.
So neither of you had back benches?
We have to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
So, they recommended it, and we had to buy them before. In my case, the equipment didn't come when I was discharged. So.
Right. And another common piece of equipment that's given often when people leave the hospital is grab bars. The one thing that's a problem with grab bars is that people need to install them. If you're in a rental, that's a real problem. And even if you're not in a rental and you have to get through tile, it's a problem. You need somebody special to install it oftentimes. And people may or may not have the resources, may or may not have the connections. So we give pieces of equipment like that, and oftentimes we were finding that maybe 50% of the equipment, something that was as crucial and as safety-wise as a grab bar, that wasn't getting used. So. Okay, so you want to show some of the, these guys have some really neat stuff here that they brought.
I guess he's got the Sabo.
Yeah.
This is the Sabo.
This is the Sabo, and you can see that there's different springs, and if you look, you can see here that the fingertips are actually covered on this. And you can imagine how hard it might be to get in. Now, right now, it looks like your hand is fairly loose. Yeah, right now his hand is fairly loose, and it can open up very nicely. Some hands don't open up quite that nicely and would take a lot of effort to open up. So Jackie is one of the few people I know who could actually independently don and doff the Sabo Flex. Okay.
Well. Because probably I'm an engineer.
Yeah, see, you had to figure it out, right?
You guys probably can.
So was the training that you had enough for you to figure it out, or you had to really kind of do trial and error stuff
no,
with that?
No, I bought a few pieces of equipment for the hand, and you guys are welcome to put it on yourself. Try to put it in one hand.
Yeah, then with one hand. Do this with one hand. Remember,
do it with
you're
one
only
hand.
Doing this with one hand.
Different spectrum of things.
Okay, this is for kind of stretching out the fingers and the wrist again. If you've got really tight finger flexors, your wrist will also tend to flex. So that's what this lovely piece of equipment is. Kind of looks like some kind of torture bivalve thing. Oh, you have a... this is neat. Okay.
Real nice thing.
This, does it work for you?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And this is another spring.
Okay. This is another stretching. This is the Sabo stretch that's used in before.
I have two, unfortunately.
And they're all not cheap.
Yeah, not cheap.
Especially this this Bioness thing. This Bioness is a unit that uses functional electrical stimulation to stimulate the muscles, again, to help actually, in this case, strengthen the muscles of the finger extensors. And you can actually push a button and say, oh, okay, I want to activate my fingers, and I can open it. We use that kind of technology with people with spinal cord injury, too, to help them even sometimes to stand or to walk even. And this is a, they have a similar piece for the leg that some people use. Now, Michael, did you have one of those?
No, I didn't.
No, you didn't. And you know, it's interesting because I've seen, again, this is about not enough training. I've seen people get sent home with these. And yeah, sure. What happens with a gait cycle with somebody who's had a stroke is they get what is called foot drop. Their muscles that usually make their toe point up are lax. They're very weak. So what happens is, as you're coming through, you're dragging your toe. And that's dangerous. And that's going to make you probably fall down. So you want to have the toe in this fixed position, which is why these guys are wearing that brace, so that when they step through, the foot's in a position where it's not going to drag on the ground. Now, they have a similar device like this that's used for the lower extremity, and it uses an accelerometer, so it looks at what's happening with the leg, and it kicks in the FES unit. It kicks in that zapping the muscle and turning that muscle on at the right time, but it doesn't always work the way it's advertised. And it's really, 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 really expensive. So we'll have you come up and look at that. Now, you've got some really great stuff, because Michael has this really great hobby that he loves.
I started photography in high school, and then I stopped because of work. Work got in the way. And so when I found myself, I had more time. I wanted to do something to overcome my boredom. So, as Debbie mentioned, you can have all the therapy you want. You can do it day in, day out, but try doing it every day for years at a time. You can get really bored easily. So I thought about, well, maybe it's time for me to get back to my hobby. But then I have one major problem. If you notice the camera, it's a right-handed shutter. And I'm affected on my right. I'm sorry. On my right side. So it took me a year to figure this out. I'm sort of somewhat of an engineer in some way, but more marketing oriented. So my first attempt was I bought this called Gorilla Pad. You can flex them in any direction, but and then you mount your camera similar to this tripod. And then you can have it, you know, position it in all sorts of ways. And like the Cartesian coordinates, you can have it 90 degrees, so you can flip it horizontal or vertical. So you can have a landscape or portrait. But the problem with this is that after 6 months, the joints fall apart.
Yeah, loose.
So I found this mini tripod, and it works the same way. So I'm able to control the camera with one hand. I chose a compact camera so I can get to the shutter. And I love manual focus lenses so you can see the challenge. So now I can actually control the lens and take camera. And what this has really done for me is you have to find your passion in order to get out there. And this has allowed me to get out every day. And the first time I had my camera, I was out for 3 hours at that time. And I never exercising and walking for that long. I used to do maybe half an hour. So the mind is so powerful enough that if you find something your client loves to do, they can overcome just about anything.
There's a lot of neat equipment out there for a lot of hobbies, for fishing, for hunting, all kinds of stuff out there. As I said, scuba diving, all kinds of things.
So that's my contribution.
any questions you guys have for my students? It wouldn't be enough. These guys right now, for whatever reason, their hands are really loose. Yeah. I've seen these guys with their hands really tight, where it takes a significant amount of effort. You know, we're not talking about, three newtons of force. We're talking about 10 newtons of force to open somebody's fingers or more. You know, something pretty substantial. So depending on how spastic somebody's hand is will depend on how much the springs you have to use, right? You can add springs to the
level of springs.
Yeah, right now he just has a rubber band on there, but there's different springs for different levels of, again, spasticity. We try to teach people to decrease their spasticity in different ways. One of the things we had talked to you guys about as a possible project was getting people to sit up or stand straight, because what happens is that when they go to move their arm, and if they stay straight, they're good. But all of a sudden, if you start moving over this side, and now you go to move it, it's like all of a sudden a lot more difficult. Did you see what happened to the fingers? See what happened to his fingers? They've curled up. And so this is what happens, and it happens because people don't realize their center is now shifted over to that unaffected side. And so it's really hard for me, especially in a group setting, to keep kind of reminding people that I can look at them and they know that they need to sit up straight. They've kind of gotten used to me. But we worked with some of these guys. And Michael, I've worked with you about for 2 years now. I've worked with some of my other clients for over 4 years in the program, the REACH program. I'm lucky to be able to have that kind of continuity. It's unusual.
First of all, you must accept where you are in life, because you have to remember where I came from and where I am today. I had a life that was so fast. I was going in and out of airport. I was traveling internationally, and literally I could be in Asia every week. So when it slowed down, my world just changed everything. So first thing you must do is learn to love where you are. If you don't, you'll be miserable. I can guarantee you that. Once you realize, I think this is true for everything in life. Once you know where you are, then you can adjust to your new normal. That's what I call my condition as my new normal. So everything is slower. I enjoy life. I count my blessings. So I don't rush things around. You tend to plan more ahead of time if you want to do things. Yeah. So that's what you have to do, plan ahead.
Jackie?
Well, for me, it's only 20 months into my stroke. I'm working on my rehab. I go treadmill, I do my own rehab. Well, unfortunately, after probably 12 months, the insurance stopped the physical therapies.
Yeah.
So we are on our own, so I read up articles, I derive my own theory, I work on my own hand. So I treat it like I count my blessing, because stroke is the only thing in the world which leaves people paralyzed, but you can fix it yourself. My theory, why people recover from stroke, because it's like damage to the brain, make me forget how to control. Nothing wrong with my hand, nothing wrong with my foot. Just need to keep on working it like an athlete. So I tell myself an athlete to retrain myself. So it's more the brain thing than the body thing. So I spend most of the time do that. I count my blessings, so because I, at least in the near term, I can afford not to work, so I better work on myself. So that's my point.
Yeah, I can attest to that. It's a mindset, you know. Part of my technical side tells me that everybody can learn. If you think about a child having to walk, you have to crawl before he can walk. And it starts slowly. So we are much larger than the child, but yet I think the brain is so powerful that you can learn anything through repetition. Yeah, maybe sometimes some of the muscular activities are not quite cooperative, but eventually you can get there.
You can. What we learned in stroke research, basic stroke research at the VA hospital when we did it, was that people 15 years out were still making
progress.
And it's about, again, how much people work on their own and how much they believe and how motivated they are to use it. And that's why, you know, pieces of adaptive equipment are very specialized, very individualized, and that's it's important. Dynamics,
and,
yeah.
Okay. In my case, I was away so much that my wife probably didn't miss me at home. But as soon as I was home, things changed because at that time when I got home, I couldn't go to the bathroom and take a shower but without her help in setting up everything. So that motivated me to try to be independent because I saw she was having difficulty and I'm not the type to be independent, to be dependent on somebody.
And Michael also couldn't talk
so
at the time.
At the time, I couldn't talk as well. I thought I could. My mind tells me I was saying the words clearly, but my wife could not understand me. So there's a disconnect of what you can say and what you think you're saying. So there's part of that. And whatever will motivate you to be independent, you do things to help yourself. And that's what I try to do with myself.
Let's make this last question. So you want to respond, Jackie?
Oh, in my case, as an engineering consultant running my own company, so, of course, I cannot run it anymore, so I just basically tell my contractor to talk to my client directly, so I'm out of the loop. So, luckily for me, and also as advice to all the engineering students from Stanford, one day you find yourself running a company, you need to balance your life and save for the rainy days. So, I did, so I can work on my own rehab instead of try to fight for a living.
Yeah, in my case, I also started the company when I had my stroke. It was we had over 100 plus employees, but yes, I can attest. Life is too short.
Yeah.
Enjoy your family. Don't get stressed out too much. You know, learn to balance your life. I agree with those things.
I hope you have a minute to come up and check out some of these devices. We're here. I can stay a little bit longer as long as it's okay with Dr. Jeffy.
Ha 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 ha!